We love lakes. And as we've been spending some time considering lakes this summer, we've debated the best in the country, the efforts to preserve them. We've been taken by how important they are to you as well.
Lake Michigan looks different every single day. Last week, sunbeams were streaming down onto water the color of beach glass, giving the effect of sparkling jewels.
Being on the lake makes me the happiest person in the world. Our lives can become so hectic, but at the lake, time really does stand still.
Ashley Van Treese of New York City, before her Mary McIlvain of Racine, Wisconsin. Lakes remind Americans how much we have in common. We spoke with the Ewing family. They've been going to the same humble lake cottage on Newman Lake in Washington State for over 80 years. Then we heard from listener Erica Edmondson from Jackson Hole, Wyoming. She's been going there too.
Our family has also been on Newman Lake since the early 1900s. My great-great-grandfather, Jack Rayome, started coming to the lake in 1915 and bought our cabin in 1922. I'm the fifth generation, and I don't know the Ewings myself, but I'm sure my great-grandparents did.
So let's go once more to the lake, which is also the title of the classic essay by E.B. White, he of Charlotte's Web fame. Harper's Magazine first published it in 1941. In it, he reflects on taking his son to the lake where he spent his childhood. They get bait and a boat, pretty simple. Then, well, here's a line read by our colleague George Hicks.
Summertime. Oh, summertime. Pattern of life indelible. The fade-proof lake. The woods unshatterable. The pasture with the sweet fern and the juniper forever and ever. Summer without end.
But then, into that summer without end, a thunderstorm. This was the big scene, E.B. White writes, a curious darkening of the sky. Then the kettle drum, the snare, the bass and cymbals. Gods grinning and licking their chops. Today we're talking lakes and literature with Tilar Matseo, author and professor of English at Colby College in Waterville, Maine. Professor, you tell us there's actually sort of a lake genre?
Absolutely. In fact, that lake in Maine is very, that you're talking about with the E.B. White, is the Belgrade Lakes, which is the Lake District of Maine, which is very near to Colby College. But there's also, of course, the Lake District in Britain that preceded that and that was very famous for the Lake School poets.
Okay, so we're going to talk about that. But Belgrade Lake, this is, again, the unnamed lake in White's essay. A listener reminded us of this piece. He said he first read it in college 30 years ago. It's a staple of freshman composition classes. Why? What's so special about it?
Well, and I teach it every year when I teach freshman comp. It's one of my favorite essays. And part of it is that he's had a huge impact on what we consider American prose style, which is this very clear, kind of crystalline prose style.
Let's listen to a bit more.
I guess I remembered clearest of all the early mornings when the lake was cool and motionless, remembered how the bedroom smelled of the lumber it was made of, and of the wet woods whose scent entered through the screen.
So one of the reasons that it's so commonly taught is it's an incredibly beautiful piece of writing. But for me, one of the things I also like about it is as a personal essay, I always say to students that I think in some ways to understand that essay, you need to remember the moment at which it was published. It was published in 1941, in the fall of 41, right before Pearl Harbor and America's entry into the Second World War. So it's really in some ways a rumination about trying to get outside of an oncoming political storm by thinking about what it means to retreat to a lake and be outside of that for a moment.
Without ever making the direct connection to what was going on. But before that, he talks about the dragonfly that lights on his rod and the outboard motors. There were just inboard motors, you know, when he'd been on the lake years ago and how they buzz around like flies too. And how he would have this weird sensation when he did something with his son that it was his father doing it.
Right, absolutely. There is a lot of productive confusion in that essay about looking at his son and feeling as though he's inhabiting his son's body or that his son is inhabiting his body. And that the sense of the physical way in which we pass history on to our children and how going to a lake in the summer in Maine, doing the same thing that your father did and having your children do the same thing is a kind of continuity of a certain kind of American experience for E.B. White.
Well, and he came up with the line that we've been using in the past month to talk about lakes, you know, describing the little camps and the paths and the outhouses and the can of lime for sprinkling around the outhouse, the souvenir counters, the birch bark canoes, the postcards that showed things a little better than they actually looked. You know, because we're not talking about McMansions on the lake here. We're talking about just small places to escape. He wrote, "This was the American family at play, escaping the city heat." But the American family at play.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I think it's what we're all trying to recreate on the 4th of July. It's that vision of the lake that I think E.B. White had, you know, that you have the red and white checkered tablecloth and you have the roast chicken and you go and buy the blueberries at the farm stand and you go for the swim in the lake and, the kids lie on the dock for the afternoon. And I think for him, even in that moment, he was looking back to this idea of a simpler history. Because, of course, 1941 was not a simple moment in the world either. You're absolutely right. I mean, there were no McMansions on the lake. I actually grew up on a lake in Maine and remember those old cottages, which I think have now tumbled down. You know, just the little cottages with the screened windows and, as you say, the outhouses. But I think even for White, that was already a nostalgic moment, an idea that there was this passing of a simpler moment. And that the 20th century was a complicated place to live.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about the lake poets briefly across the pond in Britain, inspired by lakes. William Wordsworth, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Robert Southey, the lake poets.
Right. So these were what were known as the British Romantics, poets that were living at the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century, which was also a complicated moment to be alive. That was the beginning in some ways in Britain of the Industrial Revolution, and they were really watching in Britain the end of certain kinds of pastoral agricultural landscapes. And these are a bunch of poets who retreated to the Lake District, which was still a very remote landscape at that moment. And Dorothy Wordsworth was the sister of William Wordsworth. She kept a very detailed naturalist journal, commonly available to everybody in the households, and was used as a kind of inspiration for a lot of the poetry that was written about the lakes and the mountains as well in that area.
Here's something she wrote. I walked along the lakeside. The air was become still. The lake was of a bright slate color, the hills darkening, the bay shot into the low fading shores, sheep resting, all things quiet. And of course, the poem that you think, oh, I'm not going to know this poem. Yeah, you are. It's Daffodils, William Wordsworth. We're going to have our colleague George just read the beginning of that.
I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze.
A crowd of daffodils. They are a crowd. But they weren't, I mean, they were so inspired by the lake and by nature. This is, you call them the Romantics. This is their way of, what, getting out of motion?
Yeah, it was really a reaction in some ways against the Industrial Revolution and against this heightened urbanism that was beginning to take over in England and beginning to change that culture. So it was a moment of huge economic transformation in Britain. And on the one hand, they wanted to be part of the political transformation that came with that. They were ardent supporters of the American Revolution and the French Revolution and, you know, really wanted a different vision of England that was not what was, you know, the Industrial Revolution was consolidating class differences and not opening that space up. So they wanted to be part of this political idealistic vision. But at the same time, they wanted to step outside of the economic pressures of industrialization that were bringing it to a point of crisis.
Wow. You know, I'm thinking this is heavy. You know, lakes as a way to talk about the Industrial Revolution, before that, World War II. We've heard about so many lake and literature connections. Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein on the shores of Lake Geneva, Switzerland, in 1816. We spoke to an author about that summer after a volcanic eruption. We'll link you to that story at herenow.org. Listeners wrote us about Thoreau's Walden, which is technically a kettle pond, but Lisa Bohr tweeted his quote, "A lake is a landscape's most beautiful and expressive feature. It is Earth's eye." Many listeners mentioned Lake Wobegon people. Garrison Keillor made that one up. But we'd still love to hear your lake and literature connections at hereandnow.org. As we thank Tilar Matteo, author and professor of English at Colby College in Waterville, Maine. Tilar, thank you so much.
Thank you.